From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The TV show Arrested Development is showing its final episodes tonight. Fox isn't expected to renew the quirky sitcom for a fourth season, but Arrested Development may be picked up by another network. On today's Fresh Air, we go behind the scenes with show creator Mitchell Hurwitz. Later, we talk with filmmaker Mike Mills. His first feature film, Thumbsucker, is now out on video. And rock historian Ed Ward takes us back to Berkeley in the late 60s. He profiles the band The Joy of Cooking. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is Mitchell Hurwitz, creator of the brilliant but low-rated Fox sitcom Arrested Development. Tonight, opposite NBC's opening night coverage of the 2006 Winter Olympic Games, the Fox network is showing its final four episodes of Arrested Development. But it's less a show of faith than a sacrificial lamb. Yet the Fox sitcom isn't dead yet. It won't be returning on Fox, and preliminary talks to have ABC pick it up didn't go anywhere. But Showtime, the cable network that has increased its profile lately with Weeds and Huff and Sleeper Cell, definitely is interested. The plan is to produce about three dozen more episodes for Showtime, with the entire original cast. That would result in 100 episodes and make the show a more attractive and lucrative offering in syndication. This move from network to cable TV would be extremely rare, but not unprecedented. The CBS version of the legal drama Paper Chase went to Showtime, as well as PBS, back in the 1980s. And what's exciting about the prospect of a cable version of Arrested Development is that it could be even more outrageous, which is hard to imagine. The only thing holding up the Showtime deal, according to my sources, is Hurwitz himself, who isn't sure he wants to keep doing more Arrested Development after three seasons. Tonight's four episodes, he thinks, wrap things up nicely, and he's exhausted. But the show is so good and has so much life left in it, I hope he decides to keep going. Tonight's final four episodes on Fox are full of witty masterstrokes. Like the casting of star Jason Bateman's real-life sister, Justine Bateman from Family Ties, as a guest star. Jason stars as Michael Bluth, the only seemingly normal member of a very bizarre family. And Justine plays Nellie Bluth, who's possibly his long-lost sister and definitely a high-priced call girl. In this scene, Michael learns the truth about Nellie from his eccentric father, played by Jeffrey Tambor.
And Michael confronted his father.
I know who N. Bluth is. It is Nellie, and I found her.
That's your sissy cousin Larry. Even then, we knew that's why we called him Nellie.
Do you not know that expression, Michael? I thought we were on the same page here.
It's a nice try, Pop, but in your old computer, I found a Nellie. You're trying to tell me that that is not my sister?
Yes, it's perfectly innocent. She's my prostitute. I'm a red-blooded man. I have certain needs that your mom can't satisfy.
But sex wasn't one of them.
I just want my brother to hand me my money. But he's got that hair. Why can't I have hair and money and him nothing?
She's not my sister. I let her into the company.
You didn't give her access to the cash, did you?
She said she liked me.
She's a prostitute. That's her job. Oh, no, the N. Bluth account.
What? The N. Bluth account? That is your account?
Maybe. But it's only embezzlement if you spend it outside the company. It's gone. It's empty. She got to it.
Well, there goes the company.
Okay, now hold on now. Let's not panic because I know someone who can find her. His name is Frank.
That's Job's puppet.
I'm going to prison. You haven't heard from Oscar lately, have you?
No.
Okay.
And the next day, Michael returned to the office to tell the employees that Black Friday had indeed arrived.
Hey, Ted.
Yeah?
What's going on?
Nellie got all of us our checks and these great new computers. And have you been...
Excuse me, Nellie, you did this?
I took it out of the N. Bluth account. And if you spend it within the company, it gives the prosecutors nothing. Also, it's the only way to get myself the 10 grand that you owed me.
10 grand? What did you do with these guys exactly?
They mostly just cried. You've got a real morale problem here.
You cried? Yeah, listen, I thought that you were going to...
Steal it?
Yes.
But I might be your sister, remember?
Well, the fact that you didn't steal it might actually be proof that you're not. Even if we're not related, I think I would like for you to work here. You're very, very good at it, and what you do for a job is not really a great way to make a living, you know?
I make 300 grand a year.
Marry me. It's weird on so many levels.
Arrested Development is weird on so many levels, too, but they're all great. It's won Emmys for Outstanding Comedy and for Comedy Writing. And Jason Bateman's co-stars, as members of his fairly twisted family, include Tambor and Jessica Walter as the parents, and, as his equally oddball siblings and in-laws, such quirky and delightful actors as David Cross, Tony Hale, Will Arnett, and Portia de Rossi. I spoke to Mitchell Hurwitz in November and asked him about the show's fast-paced, multi-layered brand of humor. The show is almost always described as smart, but it's also dense.
Yes, it's dense. It's dense. Well, listen, you know, I mean, it's funny. One of the things that has been one of the joys of doing the show is filling out the details. It has been just a hallmark of the show for some reason. And I think it's because myself and the other writers all come from situation comedy. And in situation comedy, you know, you're working in front of an audience, you're getting laughs, but you're only really able to get 3 laughs per page. And we've all done that for a while, and this has really been an opportunity to just pack in as much comedy as we can, because we don't have to hold for laughs. But, you know, the hope is that we can tell stories about characters that aren't stock characters by showing, you know, the inconsistencies within the character. Whereas in situation comedy, oftentimes you can only tell one story. A character just becomes a dumb character or a greedy character or a selfish character. And hopefully these characters are more nuanced, although just as absurd.
If I understand this right, Ron Howard not only narrates it and is an executive producer, but it was his idea to film using handheld digital video cameras.
That's
right. Is that true?
It is. He definitely was the visionary behind this whole thing. He wanted to do, you know, he had done both as a producer and as an actor, both single camera television shows, which are shows that are shot like a movie,
mm-hmm.
and multi-camera shows, which are shows that are, well, shot like a bad movie, I guess you would say. They're shot like a sitcom with several cameras shooting the action all at once in a 3-walled set. And his feeling was that, you know, the comedy was sharper on the multi-camera shows, the sitcoms, because there was time to vet the comedy, there were run-throughs, and you got a number of takes at it. And in film, you know, there's so much time spent lighting and putting together the technical package that when you finally get a chance to do the takes, you really only have time to do 2 or 3 takes. And, you know, he kind of was aware of this new technology, this 24p, which is 24, I guess, per second, 24 frames per second videotape, which looks very much like film, doesn't require extensive lighting, and, you know, uses kind of the vocabulary of shows like Cops or Blind Date or some of the reality shows.
There's something
to
shoot
for. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, the savings was going to be in rehearsal and in run-through. And in effect, that is basically what we have today. You know, we don't have a formalized rehearsal period. But if we get on a set at 8 o'clock, we're up and lit and ready to shoot at 8:10. And, you know, you can run the scene 14 or 15 times. And that's really where the comedy comes from. And particularly in a family piece, you know, that's where people really start to interact and overlap and learn each other's rhythms.
There are plenty of inside jokes in this show.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering...
It's very self-referential, in a way.
Well, there are some that... For example, one of the easiest ones is you always end the show with next on Arrested Development and have cast members act out things that never happen.
That don't happen, yeah.
I don't know that that's ever happened before in television. How did that idea come about?
Maybe that's not working for us. You know where that came from? The question they ask when they test these pilots, you know, there's an enormous amount of testing they do on pilots before they decide which ones to put on their schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main questions is, would you like to see this again next week? So I just thought it would be funny to kind of trick them and say, here's what's going to happen next week, right before they were asked that question. And, you know, it worked to a certain extent. And then we found, you know, this is a great way to wrap up stories and get a couple extra jokes in. And, you know, you get to end on a big laugh, whereas if you didn't have it, maybe you'd have to end on like a sort of clever piece of dialogue. And it has become just a really fun part of the show, but also a really onerous part of the show, because we'll get done writing the scripts and then say, oh, now we got to write the next on,
mm-hmm.
which is never going to happen. Look, the tough thing about this show is that it does reward those who pay attention. And my feeling has always been that there is a market for that kind of thing. I know I'm that kind of TV viewer. I love studying The Sopranos and Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Office, you know, both the British and the American one. And so although that The Office has a very different tempo, obviously, than this show. So, you know, in a funny way, we often feel that we're really making a show for the new technology here. We're making a show for TiVo, and we're making a show for DVD, and it really becomes, you know, part of our objective in making this thing. So it becomes this new this new challenge, whereas when I started writing television, much of it was disposable. There is kind of the feeling that this might stick around for a while. So we're encouraged to put as much in as we can while they're giving us the keys to the building, you know?
Mitchell Hurwitz in an interview from November. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my conversation with Arrested Development creator Mitchell Hurwitz, recorded in November. Mitchell Hurwitz, your TV your credits are pretty limited, but they start with a hit. I mean, Golden Girls, I think, is the first thing that you're credited as doing.
Yeah, that was amazing fortune for me.
So how did you get that job, and what did you learn there?
You know, I got that job the way I advise many people who want to break into this business to get a job, and I started working at the production company as a runner, which is like a gopher, really, and picked up the coffee and delivered the scripts for Paul Witt and Tony Thomas, who ran Witt Thomas Harris Productions, and they produced the Golden Girls, and I spent about a year and a half with them and worked with them personally and kind of became a type of assistant for them, and you know, was writing in the meantime, and had been writing since high school and before, obviously. But I really learned the business that way, and used that connection to get my scripts read. There are many ways to do it. Many people come out and just write what are called spec scripts or speculative mm-hmm. scripts for episodes for shows that already exist, and you know, hope to find an agent and use contacts and that kind of thing. This happened to be the way I did it. By getting to know the people involved.
But how do you go from here's your coffee to here's my script when you're handing
them
things?
You know, those are tough years. Those are really, for me anyway, they were very anxious years. And I just kept writing and more than anything kept learning and getting better. And, you know, by developing relationships with these people, and it works this way for me now with the people that work on my show, I'm more inclined to read a script of someone who's been working on the show and has been giving themselves to it than I would just to pick a script off a pile or read an agent submission. So, you know, at least for my way of thinking, that has been a more effective way to get into the business. And, you know, I'd turn in these scripts and ask people to read them, and at a certain point in my development, they were impressed enough to let me write an outside script, and then from there get into a staff writing position, which is what happened on The Golden Girls, and then you know you sort of rise through the ranks. I had developed a very strong relationship with Paul Witt and Tony Thomas, and they were you know unbelievably generous with me and put me in what they call a show running position early on. In fact, right after The Golden Girls. The Golden Girls spinoff, Golden Palace, which is often confused with the Chinese takeout place. And that was maybe the funniest thing about the show.
Now, excuse me if I have this wrong, but Golden Palace, didn't Mark Cherry of Desperate Housewives work on that as well?
You know, I'm not speaking to Mark Cherry. I'm extremely resentful. And I want to make that very clear. Yes, Mark and I worked together on The Golden Girls. Mark is a very good friend, actually. And then we did Golden Palace together. And you know, we both had similar kind of roads. We both kind of knocked around for a while. You know, Mark was always so talented. We sort of had no doubt that he would be successful. But, you know, you need a lot of luck, too.
Well, he's appeared in your show. So obviously,
yes,
guys are still at least cordial.
The children picketed Mark Cherry's house. The children picketed for, you know, keep sex within marriage.
On the show, we should say.
On the show.
Yes.
Yes, they picketed. And he came and he poked out his window and yelled, "It's a satire."
Well, what
was
it like?
Cameo.
What was it like this year when you won the Emmy for Best Writing in a Comedy and you beat out Mark Cherry for Desperate Housewives pilot?
Well, that was, I mean, obviously it was very surprising, and we didn't expect that to happen. And if anything, it was, you know, we just saw it as a promotional opportunity and focused on that. It was, you know, I feel that the Academy and the critics have been very generous towards us because they want to encourage risk-taking television, which seems to be happening more and more, by the way, that there does seem to be more risk-taking in primetime television. But I've always felt that we're the beneficiaries of that goodwill. And I think that might have been an example of that, where the Academy felt like, you know, they've got enough rewards over at Desperate Housewives. Let's do what we can to keep the show on the air. And I think it did keep the show on the air.
But since you and Mark worked together in the trenches, what did you say to each other afterward?
I, you know, mocked him, and I poked his belly with the Emmy. He was very happy for me, and I was, of course, extremely
I'm sorry you
happy
said no.
For
I
me.
Like I liked that image, by the way. I was, okay.
Oh no, he's a great guy. He was so supportive, and you know, the only loss was that we were so sure that Mark was going to win the Emmy that we had actually written a scene where Mark Cherry, the character that has appeared in our show, sued the Bluth Company for building a faulty house that he bought, and the image was going to be Mark Cherry putting his Emmy on the mantle and the Emmy crashing to the floor as the mantle gave way. So I really wanted to do that gag and poke fun of ourselves for losing the Emmy, but then we won it.
Ruined a good joke.
Yeah, we lost a good joke.
We're talking with Mitchell Hurwitz, the creator of Arrested Development. This isn't the first time that Fox has given a somewhat shortened season order. When they did it to you the first time and cut you back from 22 to 18, that ended up on the air somehow. Can you talk about that and how that was received internally?
That was a little seditious. But, you know, we made fun of ourselves, too, because we're legendarily behind on scripts. You know, I'll turn in the script at 3 o'clock in the morning that's going to start shooting at 7 that morning. So we had just gotten the cutback from 22 to 18, and coincidentally, we were looking for a device to say that their business was in peril. The Bluth Company housing business was in peril.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what seemed the obvious thing to say was that they had, you know, sold this order for 22 houses, and they just found out that it had been cut back to 18 houses. And every time someone said that, you know, another character would say, "Those bastards." but we called ourselves on it, too, because Jason, the Michael character, was on the phone saying, you know, "This is outrageous. You know, we were commissioned for 22 houses. You cut it back to 18. We had the plans drawn up and everything." And that's, we had Ron Howard say, "Actually, that part wasn't true." But they would have gotten them done on time. They always had. So, you know, we were at least saying, "Listen, we're not prepared either. But we would have made it."
And then, Mitchell, my final question sort of puts on my other hat of being a TV critic as well. One of the things that's sure so much fun about watching Arrested Development is how much it rewards people who have watched a lot of television. That there are so many TV jokes and TV performers who come in, and just the Ron Howard, Andy Griffith jokes that keep going back and forth.
Yeah. Isn't that fun? We had Henry Winkler jump the shark in one of the shows. The shark, they found a shark that they thought had bit off Buster's hand.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, in fact, you know, the right animal. So he said, well, and it was actually the episode where we were asked to mention Burger King, which was kind of a jump the shark moment, to use the television nomenclature. So Henry Winkler said, "Well, I'm going to Burger King," and jumped over a shark.
Mm-hmm. But you guys are not like anti-TV snobs that are doing a different type of television to be better than television. You are people who came from television
not
and are sort of, I don't know, glorifying in it.
I hope so. I mean, it really is, you know, there's nothing mean-spirited about it. I mean, we do come from this, and we were raised with this, and, you know, it is a big part of our culture. And we, you know, look, it's so great having Ron Howard's voice on this thing because we've heard this voice for 30 years. So, you know, what fun to be able to mention Andy Griffith. In fact, in one episode, that maybe the episode you're talking about, they had hired Andy Griffith to sit behind them in the courtroom and kind of look like Matlock. And he saw the dressing room that they'd given him and split. In fact, he was supposed to be on the show, but we couldn't get him out in time, so we had to rewrite it. But he saw the dressing room and left. And the line we gave, I guess, Lindsay was, he thought we were making fun of him. And suddenly the narrator speaks up and says, "Nobody was making fun of Andy Griffith. I can't emphasize that enough."
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
there is, you know, this deference that Ron was paying to Andy, which is kind of fun.
Well, Mitchell Horwitz, I hope you have many more years of writing and doing this sort of stuff. Thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, David. This is really fun.
Mitchell Horwitz, recorded in November. The season's final four episodes of his Fox sitcom Arrested Development are shown tonight. If the program reappears, it'll probably be on cable, but tonight's episodes could be the last. So enjoy them. And enjoy this final clip from earlier this season, in which Jeffrey Tambor and Jason Bateman, as father and son, are discussing possible courtroom tactics in the father's trial. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Now listen, we can't just go in there and plead not guilty. We have to have someone big behind us, our own private Matlock. So I made some calls, and I got him.
Got who?
Andy Griffith. Yeah, you never saw Matlock.
Not a real attorney, Dad.
Now, for 10 grand, he'll actually sit behind us in court and read the paper. For 15, he'll actually sit at the defense table. For $20,000, he'll twice lean forward and whisper something in your ear. Oh, white suit, that's extra.
Well, that's an awful lot of money for the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
The juries love him.
That's just it, Dad. There won't be a jury because we are pleading guilty.
I am not guilty. I didn't want to tell you this. Are you ready for the bombshell?
Andy Griffith wasn't the bombshell?
I'm a patsy. I was set up by the Brits. A group of British builders operating outside the OC contacted me for a partnership to build homes overseas. I did not know they meant Iraq.
We've got a picture of you with Saddam Hussein.
I thought that was the guy who played the soup Nazi.
Come on.
I told him how much I liked his work.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, filmmaker Mike Mills tells us about his varied career designing skateboards, directing commercials and music videos, and creating his first feature film, Thumbsucker. Also, rock historian Ed Ward explains why the joy of cooking is more than a collection of recipes. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. Thumbsucker is the first film directed by our guest, Mike Mills, but you've probably already seen some of his work. He's directed commercials for Nike, Levi's, Volkswagen, and MasterCard. He did the Gap khaki commercial inspired by West Side Story, and he's done a number of music videos and album covers. Mills grew up in a home in which design and painting were very important. His father directed an art museum in Santa Barbara, and his mother sold Vera scarves and was a contractor and architect. Terry spoke with Mike Mills last fall when Thumbsucker was in theaters. The film is adapted from a Walter Kern novel and has just come out on DVD. It stars Vincent D'Onofrio, Tilda Swinton, and Lou Pucci. Pucci plays a 17-year-old high school student who still sucks his thumb out of insecurity. His guidance counselor has an idea. She thinks he has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and suggests medication. In spite of his mother's skepticism, he begins the pills, and the transformation is amazing. He has more energy and focus and is relatively self-assured. Here he is with the school's debate coach, played by Vince Vaughn.
How are you doing with the medication?
I read Moby Dick straight through.
That's great. But how do you feel?
I feel like me. I never really did before.
Have you had any other breakthroughs besides the book?
It used to be kind of a hassle to put on underwear in the morning, but now it's kind of easy. Yeah. I actually listened to the words to the Pledge of Allegiance today, and they gave me chills.
Well, I've always felt that you have a real sensitivity when it comes to language. And I know that you're smart. I think that you see a lot more than you take responsibility for. And that kind of perception that you have, that can't be taught by anyone. Rebecca left the debate team. Did she say anything to you about why or?
No.
Well, I need somebody to step up and take her place. I'd like for you to compete with us.
You think I could do it?
Yes, I do.
That's a scene from Mike Mills' new movie, Thumbsucker. Mike Mills, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The main character in Thumbsucker can't stop sucking his thumb, even though he's a teenager on the verge of going into college. Is there anything you relate to about that?
Well, I didn't suck my thumb, but I had all the anxiety. It might have been a good thing if I did suck my thumb. I might have been able to soothe myself a little bit. Beyond that, it's not like I had any of these kind of tics or these sort of mannerisms, but I so much relate to that Justin character, and it became a very personal project for me writing through him.
You know, it's funny, I know that you were also a skateboarder as a teenager, and I would think that as a skateboarder you would have had like your crowd, and you would have been assertive in your own way, and that it would have been different for you than the kid in the film.
Skateboarding now is quite a trendy, it's a great way to get a girlfriend, to be a skateboarder now. Skating, when I was really doing it, when I was competing in it, was really just the biggest bunch of misfits you ever met. And, you know, all the people who couldn't find a place in the rest of the world found it in skateboarding. So we were all, you know, very disenfranchised from any sort of friendliness or any sort of feeling of like, you know, we've made it.
You know, the teenager in your movie is having a lot of troubles, and he's diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder and is given pills for it, and he desires to take the pills, and it really changes him. I mean, suddenly he's mm-hmm. he's like more focused, he's more successful, he's more aggressive, and in some ways he's more obnoxious. Mm-hmm. Did you have much experience with pills like that, either taking them or watching friends who did?
Not at that age. You know, I'm 39, and I do feel like a lot of that, you know, the medication of, you know, the introduction of pharmacology into the high school wasn't really there when I was there, or mm-hmm, maybe mm-hmm. it was, and I just didn't know about it. But it's funny, when we're doing the film, we would go around to high schools looking for locations, and of course I had to go try to find a nurse office that was right for us. And then they say, well, do you want to see where we keep the meds? And I was like, sure. And we open the door, and there's probably 100 bottles, you know, at each public high school we looked at, and I thought, wow, that's stunning. That's so unlike my world and the world that I knew, and maybe that's part of why I find it interesting, or, you know, it's in the book, but it's definitely something that I find so contemporary.
Now, I know that skateboarding has been a big part of your life, both as a skateboarder, but also as an artist. Some of the first work you did related to skateboards. You designed your own skateboards, and you designed logos for, or graphics, I should say, for those skateboards. So what kind of art did you design for your skateboards when you were a teenager?
Funnily enough, this kind of fits the Justin character. So when I was in high school, I actually made some skateboards in my wood shop, as ridiculous as it is, and I would get lots of blank boards because I knew people in different companies and I could get blank boards. But I was trying to make them all look adult and official and legitimate, you know? They weren't underground or punk in any way. I was actually trying to look sort of corporate or like real, you know? And then later on, you know, in a funny way, skating kind of came back in my mid to late 20s when I started doing designs for companies like Stereo, which is a skate company, or Supreme, which is a shop in New York. And in that way, sort of, that's, I think, what people associate me with the skate culture. But it really is funny. I'm doing the same thing I did when I was 14, 15 years old.
When you're actually doing it for real and getting paid for it, did you still feel that they should look like official corporately made skateboards, or did you try to make them more unusual?
Well, funnily, and I really put all this together, my whole way of dealing with punk rock, like as an adult, has been sort of to really look at the cliches of punk rock, because by the time I'm 30, punk rock is sort of a cliche, CBGBs, Mohawks, whatever you want to call it, sort of a ripped and torn culture is sort of what you expect. So I often play with doing things very straight, very almost corporate looking, as a subversion of what you expect from punk rock. I did a Sonic Youth cover once that was had a picture of their merchandising shirt on the front, and everything about it was very regular and straight, and in a way just trying to flip what you'd expect from them. And the same thing I did with Supreme. I did things that were very neat and regular and plain. And it was, again, it just felt wrong for what you would expect from that culture, from that person, from the kid wearing that shirt on the street. It felt wrong, and that's why I liked it. And to me, that is the excitement I got out of punk in the first place, was that wrongness, that incongruity, that sort of banana peel under people's expectations.
Mike Mills speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Thumbsucker director Mike Mills.
You came to art through what you were doing in punk music and in skateboarding. Your father was the director of an art museum in Santa Barbara. He was in the high art world. Did you relate to that world when you were growing up?
Not at all. I hated it. You know, the worst thing to do is have to go to the museum. It was a pain in the ass. And we had to do it all the time and go to these openings. And my father was, you know, my father was sort of like a social king, and he had to talk to everybody. And trying to get my father to leave any party or leave the museum was this endless Kafka-esque, you know, oh, he's never going to leave, you know. So it was a pain. And they were very social, my parents. They had parties, you know, probably every 2 weeks, like 100 people over at the house. And there'd be all these strange, you know, characters that drank too much and were lurking around the house. And my impression of the whole thing was like, these people are just nuts, you know, and this whole thing is nuts. And it's your parents, you know, it's the last thing you're going to identify with. And I used to have they would make me take these after school art classes or art clinics because, you know, you're the art museum director's son, you have to support the arts. And luckily, I did have a thing about drawing, but it was largely against my will, participating in all these kind of formal things. And I didn't come around to art. See, you know, all the art I was doing is like, you know, posters for my band, stuff around skating. And, you know, my parents really, they encouraged me, but they didn't really, it wasn't art, you know. And to me, it certainly wasn't their art. And there's this gap between me and them. And when I had that, you know, epiphany at 17, 18, they're like, oh man, I'm not going to be a professional skateboarder. I suddenly, you know, had to go over. I remember one time asking my dad, okay, Pop, tell me about 20th century art. And then it was this seminal moment in our relationship where I caved in and kind of went over to his side.
And did you like the art world any better when you were in art school?
I did at first, and I, you know, I loved so many people I went to school with, and I was so amazed by them and influenced by them. Cooper Union at the time was a strange place to go to school. It had all like the emotional warmth of like the Port Authority, you know. there's no counselors, there's no dorms. You live at the 92nd Street Y. And my freshman year, someone shot a BB gun at someone else in a critique, and someone else beat someone else up, and you know, But, you know, we had a great time. And then one of my biggest teachers, the person that influenced me the most, was a man named Hans Hacke, who's, you know, a conceptual political artist who does lots of work about the institutions of art and the kind of duplicities of it. So, you know, all my teenage rebellion from art all of a sudden got a new father figure who gave me rational, justified opinions of why I should hate art again, you know? And it eventually led me and a lot of my friends were kind of just, you know, this is the 80s art world, Mary Boone Gallery blowing up, people like Julian Schnabel are huge. We're all feeling a little, you know, disillusioned. And a lot of us got into graphics or anything like that because the money was up front. It's obviously crass. And because you're more in the public sphere. And I remember the first time I saw one of my posters wheat pasted on Broadway, I thought, oh, I made it. You know, I am not in the rarefied world of art. I am participating in the world with people and I'm in the real world, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that you put it that way because, I mean, you're talking about the gallery scene, the painting scene in the 80s as having this like really unpleasant business underside, that where money was really important and there was plenty of it. At the same time, you went on to do commercials, and two of your best known commercials are Gap commercials for khakis, and these were the two like West Side Story commercials. One was choreographed to Cool, and the other to the Mambo from the Dance at the Gym. And I mean, they're really catchy commercials, but they're commercials. And I know, like, when I was coming of age, the idea of doing commercials seemed so, well, commercial. You know,
if you
did commercials, you were selling out. Whereas now with commercials, I mean, bands break records in commercials. Bands get discovered in commercials. I mean, commercials are considered, like, much more hip and less strictly just about money. So where did you see yourself fitting in there? What did doing commercials mean to you?
Yeah, well, it's a very complicated road that I don't have resolved, and I think it's one of the more interesting problems of being some sort of, whatever you want to call it, artist-type person who's trying to have a larger audience than the art world provides. And our problem with the art world wasn't that it involved money, but that it hid the money, and it pretended that it was all about sort of an auteur definition of the artist and his creativity and his mind, and that somehow it was above and beyond, you know, human duplicities. And then when you work for a printmaker and you see that, you know, I did, there's a very famous artist I won't name, and I worked for a printmaker, and he came in one morning really hungover, sketched out his wood print, wood block that he wanted on a napkin, tossed it to me, I cut the whole thing out, you know, blew it up to the size we want, executed the whole thing. We printed it up. Someone from the Brooklyn Museum came by and said, look at the maturity in the handwork and the beauty. and you can clearly see his I'm going to give it away, partly his Scottish roots and da-da-da. And I just was like, oh, my God, this is, you know. And to be honest, it's like my parents again, reminding me of all the things that you don't like about your parents. And so anyways, we just didn't like that it was hiding the money and that it was hiding, it was, you know, mythologizing things that weren't really true. So that's kind of what got us into wanting just the money to be, you know, the crassness of it to be more exposed, more transparent, more on the surface. And I should say, it's not like what I'm saying is right, you know? This is me at 20, you know what I mean? That was my thinking at 20, 21, and what we were trying to do, and as imperfect as it was, that was our thinking at the time. And then getting into ads, you know, it's a funny thing. Like what you said before about how ads are now hip and not, you know, sort of perceived as not selling out is, I think, exactly why they're so dangerous, even to filmmakers like myself. And in the ad world, you're treated like a king as a director. The director is really overvalued. And you're kind of led to believe that you are making art, that you're not making commerce. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you didn't go to film school and you don't know how to operate a crew, you haven't done anything, and you have some want to practice, you know, and art school does develop this idea that you should practice your craft or you need to practice to get a certain level. I mean, me and a lot of people I knew did ads as kind of like going to film school or as a way to learn, because it's so expensive, you're going to learn on someone else's dime. And I remember one of the first big ads I did was for Nike, and I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what a medium shot and a wide shot and a tight shot was. And I remember like 2 days before the shoot, I went into the accountant at the production company because I knew that he wouldn't tell anybody. And I said, Tom, is a medium shot where it's like from your head to your waist, you know? And so what's a tight shot from your head to your mid chest? And then you can just cut them together and it'll work. And he's proudly telling me because, you know, the director's asking him a question. And I went and shot it the next day, you know? So I really felt like I was getting one over on the man, you know? And that I was being Robin Hood and I was taking the money I was earning and I was paying for my short films and documentaries, and I was making it so that I could do art in a gallery and not have any need to make any money off of it, you know? And at the same time, I thought I was being somehow subversive by being out in the public and that level, being, you know, that hugely exposed, and at the same time having a gallery show about death, you know? And I thought, oh, this is, I'm interesting.
As a teenager, you were into skateboarding. Do you still ever do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't skate all the time, but I definitely still skate. This is a funny image for you. My skateboard is in the back of my, you know, Volvo station wagon. That's who I am now. That's what I've become. But you know, there's some parks around that I like to go to and sort of skate in a very retired like fashion. You know,
what design is on your skateboard?
I got this one. It's kind of totally unlike me. I got it when we're shooting the film. It's from a shop up in Portland, and it's like black with a skull on it. It's completely unlike my taste. But there you go. There you go. You can't control everything.
I bet it looks great in the station wagon.
Yeah.
Mike Mills, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real honor being on your show.
Mike Mills, speaking with Terry Gross. His first feature film, Thumbsucker, has just been released on DVD. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on a 60s band named after a famous cookbook, The Joy of Cooking. This is Fresh Air. The San Francisco music scene of the late 60s was a pretty male-dominated one. But towards the end of the decade, Berkeley, across the bay, was experiencing a sea change. Some of that change was generated by a band led by two women called The Joy of Cooking. Ed Ward, who saw them many times, remembers them today.
There was a rule. If you got to have a chick in the band, she's up front. In other words, you had a chick singer. She was pretty, maybe she banged a tambourine, but she didn't write the songs or play an instrument. Which might have been okay in some parts of the country, but not in Berkeley, California. By the end of the 60s, Berkeley chicks were different. For one thing, they didn't like being called chicks. For another, there was a folk scene out there that had gone in a different direction from the one on the East Coast, which had produced the likes of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. The Berkeley scene was a lot looser, a lot more political, and a lot funkier. it didn't disdain straight-on country music nor electric blues. And thus it was the two veterans of that scene, Tony Brown and Terry Garthwaite, met up in 1967 through mutual friends who thought they should form a band. Brown wrote countryish songs, while Garthwaite leaned toward a Red Hot Mama stage persona. Brown played keyboards and Garthwaite guitar. It took a while, but a band formed. David Garthwaite, Terry's brother, played bass, and there were two sources of rhythm, Fritz Kasten on a regular drum set and Ron Wilson on congas and other percussion. This lineup led naturally to a kind of jamming, with songs lasting for a long time, which pleased the dancers who started showing up to see them just fine. They cooked so hard that they stole a name from a culinary classic, The Joy of Cooking. Before long, The Joy had a regular gig at Mandrake's, a tiny club in Berkeley that booked everyone from solo folk singers to Rahsaan Roland Kirk. As more or less the house band, they opened for touring acts and also had their own weekly headlining gig. They also played around the San Francisco ballrooms, and this brought them to the attention of Capitol Records, who signed them in 1971 and put them in the studio in San Francisco to make their first album. Capitol released the band's reworking of bluesman Furry Lewis's Brownsville as a single, and it became a big hit in Boston, rising to 66 on the national charts. The Joy toured and found themselves filling clubs in Philadelphia, New York, and New Orleans, among other places. Everyone was happy with the debut, and in the summer of 1971, they went to Los Angeles to record the follow-up, Closer to the Ground.
People everywhere going out of their minds, looking for answers and symbols and signs. There ain't no answers up in the sky. You know we got to give the earth a try. You gotta get down a little closer to the ground. That's what you have to do. Get down a little closer to the ground. Now those men up there walking.
Terry's brother David was gone, replaced by Jeff Naber, and the sound of the album was fuller, more produced, with more overdubs. In short, it was to the taste of radio at the time. But in a story that was to become ever more frequent over the next decade, the executives at Capitol, who'd supported The Joy of Cooking's first record, left the company. And although the band was as good as ever live, and Tony Brown's songwriting was getting more prolific than ever, she wrote the majority of the songs this time, Closer to the Ground wasn't promoted, and there was no hit single. But a contract's a contract, so the next summer the band convened in their Berkeley rehearsal studio to record a third album, Castles.
Let love carry you. Let love carry you. Lean back, let love carry you along. Let love carry you.
Let love carry you.
Let love carry you.
Let love carry you.
Lean back, and let love carry you.
Feel tired, everything's gone wrong. When you wake up in the morning and you know that the day's gonna be too long.
It was far and away the band's best effort, with the best songwriting and singing and playing they'd ever recorded. Why the record company packaged it in a silver cover showing an industrial site and then failed to promote it at all is a complete mystery. But the lack of promotion, along with the band's being tired of touring, saw them fall apart. Tony and Terry gave Capitol a last album of country material to fulfill their contract, and The Joy of Cooking was no more. Today, Terry still sings on occasion around San Francisco, and Tony is a successful artist. The old Joy records have worn well, as has the idea that women and bands are far more than decoration.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. That's Godzilla's pounding footsteps and horrific roar. We've learned that Akira Ifukuba, the composer who wrote the score for the 1954 Japanese monster classic, died earlier this week at the age of 91. We'll close with music he wrote for that film. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Caliph's House, A Year in Casablanca, An Account of Remodeling a Dream House by travel writer Tahir Shaw. From the Susan and John Turbin Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, saying goodbye and waiting for word. Families left behind by the war in Iraq. We talk with Kristen Henderson about her new book, While They're at War. Also, Law & Order's S. Epatha Merkerson tells us about winning the Triple Crown of TV Awards with an Emmy, a Golden Globe, and a Screen Actors Guild honor. Join us for the next Fresh Air.